Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio. Today, my special guest is author Kevin Sullivan, whose new book, The WWE Championship, published by WWE, is coming out on November 23rd. How are you doing today, Kevin?
Good, Jason. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. We've
Good.
got just yeah. Tell me a little bit about the book.
Well, as the title suggests, the title is The WWE Championship. It's a complete history of the WWE title, dating back from 1963. Actually, you know what? Let me rewind. It's actually back a couple of years before 1963, because we start with Buddy Rogers' NWA title reign and how that actually evolved into the beginning of WWE, which is it could be a whole book in and of itself. But it's a I tell people who are fans, and they all know what I'm talking about. You're familiar, I'm sure, with the almanacs or the online lists of the championships, right?
Sure.
Well, I loved those. I always studied them, who had how many days or when titles changed. So I really, for whatever reason, had an affinity for these lists. But then at the same time, I hated them for some reason. So this is actually the exact opposite of those lists. Because you look at those lists and you have, for example, the Iron Sheik's reign, and it looks like, just a quick reign out of nowhere, a couple weeks, and then Hogan comes and Hulkamania takes off. But in reality, at least in my opinion, and what I tried to do in the book was, that was a pretty pivotal reign. It's bridging two eras, and while doing so, it was soaked with controversy, because as you have that whole Vern Gagne thing where he's offering Sheik $100,000 to break Hogan's legs. And then you got Sheik telling me in the interviews for the book that he would never do that. Obviously, that's no secret. But then he goes up to Hogan afterwards. Hogan gives him a big hug and a kiss in the locker room. But to this day, Sheik claims that Hogan pretends it never happened. So Hogan was on board then, and now Hogan's got his own version of the story. So I know I'm a little long-winded here, but the book is more of that type of stuff, more of there's a story here with this title. There's ups and downs and peaks and valleys. It's not just a list of this guy won and you saw him lose that Survivor Series. Then this guy won it at SummerSlam.
Yes.
To me, that's boring.
Yeah, no, that sounds like really, interesting details. Yeah, I mean, obviously, heard the Sheik story, but never, from his words or any, never really knew many of the details about it. That's interesting. Of course, Hogan's story always kind of changes, by the day, so it's kind of hard to keep track of what he's going to say, but looking back, who do you th I mean, obviously, the important, the significant champions, Bruno Sammartino, Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, John Cena. I mean, these are obviously, the guys who you think of as, the really important, the major champions. But if you're, like an Iron Sheik, who's someone who, may not be as well known as a champion, but really, had an important reign?
I'm not sure if he falls under the category of not well known, but there's two people I don't think get enough credit. One is, and I understand the heat I'm going to take for this. One is JBL, the old school aspect that he brought back to the title, to me was amazing. And then he holds it for 10 months in an era where you don't hold the title for 10 months. It was unheard of. Similar is Yokozuna. He really had a stranglehold on that title for a year, not counting his WrestleMania 9 victory, obviously. But he was a heel to fear, which even in that period, you didn't have too many of those. So I think those are two champs that you don't really hear a lot about when you talk about the greatest. Probably because they're heels and you don't talk about heels when you talk about the greatest. Just thinking out loud, I thought a quick reign, but obviously, and a I don't know if the word is pivotal, but a important reign, at least as far as history goes, is Sergeant Slaughter.
Yeah.
Everything that went around it was, amazing with the whole Iraqi turncoat. Then he tells stories of his wife and kids and death threats, and he had to have security around his house 24 hours a day, all because he was champion of WWE. Like, that's
Yeah.
amazing that someone would threaten to kill you because you're a champion of WWE.
Well, it shows the value the belt had then, and certainly it's it's the number one title in wrestling, and it's very important. But I think there's certainly been a way that the perception of that title has changed in the past couple of decades. I mean, I think obviously the introduction of the World Heavyweight Champion, the fact that the belt changes hands so much. I mean, how do you think that's So you kind of talk about like kind of the evolution of how the title has sort of, the perception of it and the value of it has changed.
Yeah, I don't think there's a person around today that will tell you that it means the same that it meant even 10, 15 years ago. It's, when as a historian that bothers me, or as a self-proclaimed historian that bothers me, and it really ate at me for a little bit. But the truth is, it's hard for the title to mean that much. I mean, obviously, still means a lot, but mean what it did then when it's being defended every time you turn around, twice a week, maybe. It's there's 14 pay-per-views, 52 Raws, how many house shows? Back in Bruno's day, he defended it probably once a month against like Waldo Von Erich, So it's a little different game, and I guess the title has to change when you're going to be putting it out there in front of the public so much,
Yeah, there's definitely been. I mean, obviously, the changes in the industry have kind of fed that. I think there's certainly like a lack of patience though today. I mean, it's either it's just fans or it's the people in charge or both that it's like we need to shake things up. But, let's do a title change, or we want to pop a nice rating on Raw. Let's do a title change. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of, I guess it's more short-term thinking than long-term thinking,
Yeah, it's hard to argue that, and it's a different side story, but I would say Jack Swagger's a perfect example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's interesting to see, obviously, the perception of him, it hasn't really changed, even though he held a world title. He's kind of back in the same position he was in before. And yeah, I think it's interesting how the title, it's been given. It used to be you would get the guy ready, and you would build him forever, and then you'd make him champion. And now, it's like we want to make this guy into a big deal. Let's give him the title.
Exactly. Well, back in the day, it was he needs to get the IC title first and then go build up. Now you have Sheamus just comes out of nowhere, wins the title.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's weird how it's evolved. And if I could read your mind, I think there's not really a true reason for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, at least in Sheamus, I mean, that's sort of a split thing where, at least in Sheamus's case, I mean, it certainly helped him, and he's just pretty established as, maybe not quite top, but next to the top guy, with Swagger, obviously, it didn't work. So it's not, it's definitely a shift in philosophy, and it's interesting how that has changed. You also worked for WWE.com and also WWE Magazine for about 10 years. Tell us about how did you start working there, and tell us about some of your experiences.
Sure. Yeah, I started there in 1998. It was immediately, it was the Monday after SummerSlam in MSG.
Okay, yeah. Highway to Hell.
Yeah, Highway to Hell, Stone Cold and Taker.
Yeah.
So I was there the Monday right after that. I started in the .com department as a content editor, where
Okay.
I stayed I was in .com the entire time. My most recent position there was a director of content development. In short, I was responsible for all the content on the website. In between there, I wrote for the magazine. I always wrote for the magazine just here and there, whenever I had time or whenever they needed somebody. But in when the brand split came, the company decided to make the website and the magazine one department.
Okay.
So at that point, I took over the Raw magazine, and I was the managing editor of that magazine, which sounds a lot fancier than it was. There was, obviously the editor in chief was ahead of me at that point, but it was really more of an experiment with .com and the magazine working together, and it was a short one. Let's just put it at that.
Okay. That's interesting. Yeah, it seems like there's been kind of a shift in WWE.com over the years as to like how there was a time where they were commenting on like other like industry news, like they were trying to kind of be like a you could kind of get all your wrestling content at least like in certain parts of the site. And
Right.
did you find that sort of the philosophies on what to do with the website kind of changed over the years?
Oh, over the by, day by day, it would change. And it
Okay.
was, I wouldn't call it a joke, but the saying was everything's on a case by case basis. So if you try to say, well, last year we didn't do this for WrestleMania, the reply would be, well, now we are. It's a case by case basis. But the industry or the company is moving so fast and so quickly, and there's so many different like tentacles out there and arms that I'm sure there's other things going on that the people, at least when I was there at .com, don't know about, that almost have to react to what the higher ups are saying. So if Vince says do this, you do this. That's just the way it is. But yeah, as a director of content, it was a little frustrating. But you have to kind of take a set seat back, a step back, and say, well, it's Vince McMahon. He got this far. He knows what he's doing.
Sure.
Yeah, and at the time we were doing 20 million monthly uniques, at least at the time when I, 07, 08 when I left. So something was working.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I just thought of this. Obviously you left in 08, so you were gone when this happened, but when Daniel Bryan's the finish for SummerSlam was there was a story went up on the website saying that Daniel Bryan had returned and basically giving away what happened at SummerSlam like an hour later. Did first of all, did anything ever like that happen when you were there? And if so, what kind of reaction did it have, or what do you think would have had?
Yeah, unfortunately, we've been there. Two that come to mind were one of the drafts, one of the early drafts or lotteries or whatever they were calling them back then. The supplemental was on .com, but we launched the results to it a couple hours before the actual superstars knew.
Okay. Oh,
So.
wow. Yeah.
Right, so I think it was A-Train and Randy Orton. I think Randy Orton might have been too young, but two of those guys, those are the two names that we let out. I know one was A-Train. I forget who the other one was. So A-Train calls up like, well, "What's going on? I thought I was on SmackDown, and he's going to Raw or vice versa. It was a while ago." Obviously you just grin and bear it. What are you gonna do?
Yeah, well, yeah.
I hate to say that as your excuse, but when we had 20, probably 20 people working on the content side, and yeah, we messed up. Let's just leave it at that.
And people obviously mess up, and but once it's online, people are gonna see it, and it's. I work in newspapers. I'm a copy editor, so I, keep people from, to try to avoid, letting mistakes through. But, obviously something like something's people make mistakes. People are human and they're gonna screw up. So, I've, I guess everyone sort of heard, stories, true or not about, Vince McMahon blowing up about, for whatever reason, things happening. So, I don't know how, much you interacted with Vince or anything like that, but whether, I'm sure a fan would wonder, kind of, what it would be like to work in that company. And obviously you being there for 10 years, must have some interesting stories.
Yeah, not any that I could probably tell. Actually, I do have some
No.
that I could tell, but
Sure.
the good ones will stay with me. But yeah,
Understood.
I worked closely with Vince for a little while.
Okay.
Towards the end of my career there, I traveled with him, which was a nice treat. I'm sure fans would love to do that, and I saw it as an opportunity to learn, and that's how it was presented to me, as an opportunity to learn the company from him directly.
Wow.
So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
As far as who he is and what type of, rumors and whatnot, I never saw that. And like I said, I worked closely with him for a while. I worked very closely with his son.
Yeah.
I never got the brunt of the, I know I've heard it and I know it's out there, but I've never actually gotten the brunt of it.
Sure. Well, good for you. Must have been doing a good job.
Something happened. Got lucky.
Yeah. Let's move to when did you, what first got you interested in pro wrestling?
I think I started watching maybe a little before WrestleMania 1, and it was really only because the kids at school were talking about it and I had to check it out. They were a little ahead of the wrestling game than I was. So I checked it out. I guess for the first couple of years I kind of split time between NWA and WWE. And then I would say, the thing that really grabbed me, and it was a good 2 years after this, or 3 years actually, was when Andre grabbed Hogan on Piper's Pit
Yeah.
and ripped his crucifix off his chest. I mean, I sat there like, obviously I'm thinking like, this is real. Like, how can he do that to him? It's his friend.
Yeah.
I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, me
From that point on, I was like, I pledge allegiance to WWE. I'm here. Hogan, you better kick his ass. That kind of thing.
Right. Yeah, that's that obviously it's pretty major memorable moment in wrestling. And yeah, that was a I started probably around 86, so a little bit after you. And yeah, that was the one that really stuck out to me even more than that was the Savage dropping the ring bell on Steamboat's throat.
Oh, that was great.
Yeah, I just couldn't believe, like, I you know it just what a horrible injustice. And I was aghast that a man could get away with this. But so yeah, there's those are obviously great times. And who were some of your favorite wrestlers?
I always liked the heels growing up. I'm not sure. I think maybe I think it wasn't until Brett that I started liking the faces, but
Okay.
early on it was Brutus. Loved Brutus Beefcake.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, heel Brutus Beefcake. I
See,
hated the barber.
I loved him. I loved him as a barber. But
Oh, you did?
I see. I was well. I was 8 or 9. I'm not sure how old you were, but so I was kind of young. So, I mean, I always liked the baby faces. I never, Savage. I kind of liked parts of when he was a heel, just because Savage was my favorite. But yeah. But I loved baby faces through and through. I was
I
always mad
got
when my favorite guys turned heel. Like when Rick Martel turned heel, I was steaming mad.
it gave him a career again.
Well, Strikeforce was a, yeah, I guess, they kind of languished a little bit, but see, I always think, yeah, I've said this before, but I always think that Rick Martel was like the best babyface ever, and that, not that he wasn't good as the model, but like I always thought kind of like the model was like a caricature, and he was just kind of playing like. I don't know. It was just he was playing this act, and he was doing it fine, but it just didn't like it was like a two-dimensional character where him as a babyface was like a three-dimensional character. I don't know. It's hard to explain, but
No, I got you. You're the Rick Martel fan.
I am the Rick Martel fan. Hey, Rick Martel is pretty good. So who else, sorry to interrupt, but who else were some of your favorites?
No, that's fine. I liked Savage, and as the years went on, I became a huge Bret Hart fan.
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah, same here.
And then, right before I started, they did the screw job.
Right.
Well, I guess that's a year before I started.
Yeah.
And I mean, it tore me apart. I was like, are you kidding me? How are you gonna screw Bret Hart? I respect Shawn Michaels in the ring. He's great. And now it's The Miz. I've been on The Miz bandwagon for the better part of 3 years.
Yeah.
And Christian, big Christian fan.
Yeah, Miz definitely one of those heels that you like. You know,
Yeah.
he's very strong in that role.
Yeah. And I thought Christian was the same. And, right now he's obviously in a different role.
Yeah.
I like him better in his heel role, personally.
He's good at both, but yeah, I think as a heel, the personality really kind of shines. As a babyface, he can work really well. I mean, he can. I was at Royal Rumble this year, and he wrestled Ezekiel Jackson, and I didn't watch ECW much, so I was kind of familiar with that he was doing good work, but I hadn't seen it. And then I was really impressed with the match that he got with Ezekiel, and the live crowd really, really dug the match. Kind of pulled something out of a guy who
Yeah.
is competent, but definitely it was Christian doing the work in that match, and you could clearly tell.
Sure.
Yeah. Are there any matches in particular that stand out for you?
Yeah, so hard, there's been so
Yeah, a lot of
many.
matches, yeah.
One thing I when someone asks me that, the one thing for whatever reason I always go to the negative, but one match that I just think was wildly overrated is the WrestleMania 12 Iron Man match
Oh,
for some
okay.
reason.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I wildly is a little stronger than I feel, but I do feel like, I think even WWE's kind of tried to make it as like the greatest WrestleMania match of all time, or at least at one point they were kind of hyping it up as that, and it's you're not really, maybe borderline top 10.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll give you borderline top 10, largely because of what was at stake, and it was HBK's first title. But the surroundings, I think, made it a much better match than it actually was.
Yeah.
Loved Bret vs. Owen WrestleMania 10,
Oh yeah.
obviously. Who didn't?
Yeah.
And I was there for that, and I remember watching, thinking, "Oh my God, how the hell are they going to opening match? How are they going to follow this up?" But they had the ladder match that succeeded, obviously.
Yeah, and that story is just so great at the end. Bret, triumphant winning the title, and then Owen looking on, with disgust, in the entrance way, and that just set that up so beautifully.
It really did, and it's so it was so predictable, even from the opening bell of the night. Once Owen won, you kind of knew what was going to happen, but that's okay. I always have that argument with people is you don't need a surprise all the time. And I think TNA could take notes here because,
Yeah.
sometimes it's okay for a fan to be like, see, I told you, or I knew that was going to happen. You don't have to surprise us all the time.
Yeah, well, I mean, part of wrestling is, building to something that you're excited about and wanting to see, like, oh, that good guy, I want him to, finally vanquish that evil guy. It's so yeah, you might know what's going to happen, but it's still, you understand that, hey, a story is going to pay off in a way that makes me happy. I want to go see it.
Exactly. Couldn't
Yeah.
have said it better myself. Exactly.
Well,
The
thanks.
but I'm more of a, I'm like that. I'm more of a story guy than I am a matches guy. So while I enjoy Daniel Bryan and Dolph Ziggler, I'm more of like a I thought Bret versus Piper at WrestleMania 8 told a nice story.
Oh, yeah.
Especially towards the end, you got Piper with the bell. Should he do it? Should he not? And he's probably thinking back to his family, being young, that type of thing. That got me. Savage versus Warrior. Here's Warrior's a horrible wrestler.
Oh, yeah.
Horrible wrestler. At WrestleMania 7, got me. I'm on board with that match.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. And the angle with Elizabeth afterward, I mean, just, that's That's, I mean, talk about a story. I mean, you know, the Savage Elizabeth story, you know, went back 6 years, and you know, just you know, just to have, like, in one moment, one embrace, you know, just the complete redemption of, you know, kind of a pretty evil character, you know, for the, you know, for that, such as that last, you know, 2 years was, yeah, it was pretty tremendous.
Yeah, I definitely agree. It's matches like that. I would say, and I hate to use Brett again, but Brett versus Backlund at Survivor Series 94, not necessarily a good match, but wow, what a story. You know, while I was talking to Brett for the book, he told him a funny little story. Is they're going over the match prior, and you know, he tells his mom what's going to go on. And then they're out in the arena, they're doing the thing. Bulldog goes down, hits the stairs, falls down, you know, he's knocked out. And here's Brett. He's like, "My mom, who's the nicest woman in the world, wouldn't hurt a fly, just steps over her son-in-law, who's probably dead, as if he's not even there, you know, and then, like, cries over me." He said he got a good kick out of that.
Well, that was always the funny thing about that match is, like, yeah, no one is concerned about him lying on the floor dead for 20 minutes when, you know, obviously the incredible drama is going on in the ring, you know. Yeah, I mean, Brett was such a great storyteller, you know, even still, you know, in his matches. You know, maybe the Vince Brett match didn't really, the storytelling there was a little crazy, but you know, he's just so good in his, you know, his gestures and his movements at really, you know, telling a story in a very, you know, in a very subtle way.
Yeah, and I don't think he gets enough credit for that, to be honest with you. He said, and I just printed this on my site tonight, is he gets a lot of criticism for being too into it, or thinking too much, or, you know, trying to be too good, or trying to be the best champion. And he's like, "Well, if that's the criticism I'm gonna get, you know, trying to be the best, then that's fine with me."
Yeah, that's not a bad criticism. Who are some other people that, I mean, I'm sure you interviewed a lot of people for the book, but who are some notable ones that you think people will, you know, be really interested in what they have to say?
Let's see. Talk to Iron Sheik, obviously. He, you know, I probably understood 20% of what he was saying, which was interesting. I couldn't get Andre, obviously. We all know he passed away a while ago. So I talked to Ted DiBiase, who was amazing. I mean, he gave me so much good stuff. A lot of it I couldn't put in because he wasn't a champion. But I did manage to squeeze some of it in. A lot of it was very emotional, how, you know, he was given the belt or the title. He took it back to his hotel room, you know, puts it on the nightstand or whatever, and just stares at it for God knows how long, thinking back to his father, when his father was, you know, when he was young, his father would bring home titles and he would run around with the belt, that kind of stuff. So that was a lot of fun. He thinks he has a future champion in the family, which I wouldn't disagree with Ted. Or I don't know much about Brett, but I'm sure he's decent. Sarge was good. Slaughter was good. Like I said, he went into the whole death threat stuff. Flair is always a good time. Flair went into this whole, it might not have made the book, so I might as well tell it here, is when Arquette won the title, the WCW title. They were all at the hotel bar or whatever, and people are buying drinks. So Flair goes up to Arquette and he's like, "Are you kidding me? You're the champ. You buy the drinks." And Arquette didn't, he didn't even bat an eye. He put his card down, bought drinks for the entire bar all night. So then they were, you know, a couple drinks deep, and Flair goes, "Well, where's your title? Where's the belt?" So he made him go up to the hotel. So the rest of the night he's wearing the belt the whole night. So then he's like, "Well, hold on, hold on, hold on. This isn't it. You got to wear my robe." So he went up and got his robe. Yeah, so Flair was a good time. HBK is obviously always good. Stone Cold is great. Gave me a good couple hours. We've worked together in the past, obviously, so he was good. Sid, I don't know if I've been on a couple different podcasts. I don't know if you heard my Sid story. I told one this morning,
Oh,
and
no, I didn't hear it.
I mean, it's not so much of a story as much as I you ask these guys pretty much all. I guess there's a handful of stock questions, and then there's probably 20, or depending on how much time, unique questions to them. But I asked Sid the one stock question is, what did it mean to you to become WWE champion? Thinking that he'd be like, oh my God, it was the greatest thing ever. He comes at me with, Kev, I really didn't want the title. So this changes my entire line of questioning. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, the damn thing was so heavy, I didn't want to have to carry it through the airport. And he was serious. So that's just the kind of guy he was.
Yeah, I've heard Warrior say something similar to that too, or at least I've read that he said something similar to that. So I
I did
guess
not talk
maybe,
to Warrior.
well, yeah, I didn't think so, but
Yeah.
I guess maybe terrible wrestlers share that in common. They don't care about the title. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe that explains why they're not very good wrestlers. Maybe
Probably.
they don't value that so much.
Yeah, they didn't get it.
Yeah, I guess, kind of Sid with his personality, that's interesting. One thing I'm talking back kind of to your experience with WWE. How did you get the job in the first place?
I got lucky. It was right out of school. My sister was working in the industry, not wrestling, but television industry, and she was doing a show on wrestling. So one of the office workers at Titan Towers was at her show, and my sister just by chance said, "Hey, why don't you take a look at my brother's resume?" And it just kind of snowballed from there.
Well, that's cool. Well,
Yeah.
that's yeah. I mean, obviously, I think most people listening to this at least have maybe some small dream of wanting to be involved in pro wrestling somehow. So be working with WWE for 10 years, and to have written this book and also the 2009 New York Times bestselling WWE Encyclopedia as well. Are obviously must be a wonderful experience.
I'd say wonderful experience, definitely. All luck. I'm not trying to be funny, but it's all anybody could have gotten the job that I got. I just got lucky and they picked me.
Well, yeah, oh, go ahead.
And then I really just stepped in it. I got lucky with the encyclopedia and it just started snowballing. Done a handful of other kids' books now. I think I'm on my sixth book now, and supposedly signed for eight, but I don't remember signing anything. So yeah, it's kind of just right place, right time kind of thing.
Well, you do good work, and definitely we fans should check it out, and tell everybody where they can find you.
Twitter, of course. I'm at Sullivan Books is my handle. Online, I am at kevinsullivanbooks.com. And Amazon, obviously, yes. Search WWE Championship and you'll find the book.
And of course, this is no one should confuse you for the other Kevin Sullivan. I guess you don't have a heavy Boston accent, so that.
But you'll be surprised. I mean, every day I get something.
I guess obviously, Kevin Sullivan in wrestling, people are naturally going to wonder if they don't know.
Exactly.
Well, Kevin, really, really appreciate you doing the show, and like to congratulations on the new book. I hope it sells really well, and hope you continue doing good stuff.
Great, I appreciate it.
All right, and everybody, you can check us out at WrestleSpective.com. You can email us at WrestleSpective at gmail.com if you have any questions or suggestions or criticisms or whatever. We're also available on twitter.com/WrestleSpective, or facebook.com/retrospective. So any of those ways are what I always like to hear from people. And so anyway, thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon.